Welcome, friends, to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We gather together on a regular basis, twice a week, and we spread broadcast the ideas of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, with the main idea being that to put forth the idea of universal brotherhood. There is a declaration that all the ULTs around the world read, and it's like a binding sort of a thing. Each lodge is independent, but this declaration is the main thrust of what the philosophy puts out. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification of practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in order for this lodge to fulfill the grand ideas in the declaration, we have two meetings a week. As today, our doors open at 10:30. The meeting goes from 11 until 12. We have a book table in the foyer that sells straight-line theosophical ideas only at cost for shipping and printing. We make no profit off of them. And the book table is open before and after each meeting. So on Sundays, each month has an overall umbrella topic. For this month in June, we are looking at the idea of practical theosophy. Today we'll be looking at two ideas that go hand in hand, study and work. We will have two speakers. On Wednesdays, we continue to study The Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky, and the meeting runs from 7:30 until 8:30. The library, which is in the front of the building, is open on Wednesdays from 5:15 until 7:15, and then the meeting starts at 7:30. The library will have the readings that we will be studying Wednesday night, as well as an accompanying reference that kind of gives a deeper idea of what that topic is for that night. There's always a student available. If you have any specific questions, if you want to start your own study on something, we always have a student librarian available. All of the activities that you see here are all by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. We do have a big old building, and any contribution given in the right spirit, it doesn't matter how much it is always welcome. And people up on the platform, at the book table in the library, we're all volunteer, and we're all students. We're all learning this philosophy. So we think that's about it for the announcements. So our meeting today, as we said, will be on the idea of study and work. We will have two short talks, and of course, we're always taking questions and discussion on these topics. So we'll look at the idea of study first, and then we'll have another talk on work. So just to start out, a quote from one of the masters: lead the life necessary for the acquisition of knowledge and powers, and wisdom will come to you naturally. So this is kind of the idea of what's the grand idea of what study will entail. And we will be certainly looking at study in a way that we're not used to thinking of that activity. So the definition of study, there were two of them in the dictionary. One, the devotion of time and attention to acquiring knowledge on an academic subject, especially by means of books. And two, a detailed investigation and analysis of a subject or situation. So mainly it looks as though study is just seems to be a concentrated looking at a specific subject. So theosophy has a trinity of sorts of unity, study, and work. This particular talk will kind of touch on unity, and then the second talk will look at work. But how do these come together? How does unity and study, one wouldn't really think that those two things coincide with each other. But unity in this sense, as was in the Declaration, is looking at the idea of universal brotherhood. And we have to understand that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. And how do we come upon that idea? Well, if we look at the first fundamental, which is that of deity, and we look at deity as everyone has that spark, well, everyone is that spark of that deific essence in that we are all gods in the making. So if we're looking at universal brotherhood, then we are all one. We are all unified in that deific aspect. So when we're looking then at the idea of study, then we're looking at this acquisition of knowledge, that when we're studying something, we really shouldn't be studying it on the idea of gaining knowledge just for ourselves, but that we're looking at this idea of gaining knowledge to help others. And then once we get this knowledge, then the idea of work will come in for others as well. So this God within, this is our connection with all life, and even what we're studying is a type of connection that we are making with other ideas. So why do we study? What are we studying? And how are we studying? So why are we studying? Of course, studying the philosophy, it's paramount that we do study it, because if we don't continue studying it and discuss it with others, then the philosophy, in a way, can kind of disappear. And we have to be able to share these ideas with others in an understandable manner. So we have to study in order to be able to share it with others. So we speak of self-induced and self-devised means in our classes all the time, having to do with studying. But it's also important that each lodge as a whole, and there are even study groups in cities as well, people getting together and looking at these ideas and sharing and talking about them. But having a lodge, and especially where we're very lucky to have this lodge where it is, and it by having all these ideas, all this discussion, all this goodwill, by it all coming together, and we're talking about one idea, that of the philosophy of theosophy, we know that thoughts have power. So we're putting, this is like a beacon here in the city of Philadelphia, is this lodge. And many of us may not really think about that on a regular basis, but the impressions and the energy that come out of here really do affect others. And we have to, as we said earlier, we have to eliminate the desire to obtain knowledge only for ourselves. And even we know that so much of these ideas, we read them, it's like, what? But the thing is, when we do study, and even if we don't understand it, we are making our minds porous to the promptings of our higher nature. And we have to keep on. We think it was Mr. Judge talks about, even if we don't understand something, keep trying, keep reading, keep discussing. Because even if we don't understand it, we still are getting benefits from it by making our minds porous to the higher promptings. So what is it then that we're going to be studying? There's a lot of literature that we have a choice of. And sometimes it's like some people really get a lot out of the Bhagavad Gita. Other people get a lot out of the Voice of the Silence. There's so many books. It is suggested maybe in the beginning to just discuss and read the ideas of karma and reincarnation. And then maybe once one gets a good foundation, and then go on like to the ocean of theosophy and the key. And we know that the secret doctrine is always what can one say? It can sometimes seem very intimidating. And HPB's first book, Isis Unveiled, is another one that can be read. So if one has any questions about the books to read, we always have somebody at the book table. We have the person in the library. Mr. Judd states to start off slowly, studying one or two books until they're well understood. And Mr. Judge has a very interesting article called Much Reading and Little Thought. We're going on how one studies now. And we do have that in a pamphlet at the book table. And he warns against doing too much reading, light reading, and skimming. Even skimming the philosophy, he warns against, because we're not really concentrating, and we are aware of the whole thing with concentration and meditation, the importance of that. So he does warn against just skimming things, but being able to read in a concentrated, pointed manner. He says a few books well read, well analyzed, and thoroughly digested are better than many books read once over. So we'll just, we want to just mention two other quotes that we found, and these will kind of segue into the next talk. The ULT will flourish upon studying the philosophy and ethics leading up to work. And the second one is, but even all this good study, if not combined with practice, is worth nothing. And just to end our talk, just this is one of the pamphlets that are out at the book table, Work for Theosophy. And this is from Mr. Judge's article on study and work. The taking up of these ideas, in effect, a new mental incarnation, and we, just as the case of a new man Vantara, have to evolve from the old estate and with care gradually eradicate the former bias. So study and work will change our minds and our hearts, and we will be able to help others.
Friends, when the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875 to be the basis of the emergence of the modern Theosophical movement, there were three objects. And the first of those objects really focuses us, for us in a nutshell, what our work for Theosophy primarily is. And that is the establishment of the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. So we might think that, well, let's be clear in our minds, let's get a clear idea of what is that nucleus mean that we are to establish. Well, we're pretty sure we understand that a nucleus is a center, but it is, can be a special kind of center. It can represent the core, the essence of a thing or a movement. It can be a center from which radiates out influences and directing impulses, such as the nucleus of a cell. It can be a center which attracts various elements that are in their combination and unity together perform a certain definite function, such as the nucleus of an atom. So a nucleus can also be a germ that contains within it the potential for much greater things, such as the germ or seed or nucleus of a plant. So we have before us this idea of the nucleus of universal brotherhood that we are to establish it. But where are we supposed to establish it? And we might say that we find there are three ways. They're all interdependent, they're all interblended, but there are three ways we can establish the nucleus. One is, of course, we can begin within ourselves, in the core of our nature, where lies the basis by which we think and feel and relate to the world and to others. The core, the center, the nucleus of our being. We certainly can work there to establish a foundation of brotherhood. But then we can move out from there and look at the city at which we live, or the community, or even a group of families that we are associated with. And there, in a sense, there is the establishment of a nucleus of universal brotherhood in the terms of lodges or various other theosophical type organizations or associations, where groups of like-minded individuals that share a common aim and purpose get together to work for the benefit of that particular community. And of course, in our technological age, our digital age, many of these groups have means by which they can send that message or that influence across space and time and place to reach the ears and eyes of many who cannot be in that community. And then the other way, the third way in which we establish that nucleus is in the world itself, among humanity. That means to individually work for humanity in any way and every way possible for the cooperation, the tolerance, and the amelioration of the general human condition, to uplift it, to be of service to humanity as a whole. So there are these three ways we can work. But work here, in the sense that we do it, is one of individual devotion. No one is ordering or telling one. There is no individual who is assigning particular ways in which we work. It's all through self-induced and self-devised effort, or we might say individual devotion. And the reason for this is given to us in the third fundamental proposition, where all human evolution, and therefore all projects and endeavors of human evolution, do not come about by chance. They don't come about by miracle. They don't even come about by the natural impulses of nature. But they all come about through self-induced and self-devised effort, both individual and collective. So our work here, not just as individuals, as said, but together as a group, is independent. We may work towards the same goals, but the ways we do it, the emphasis we put on it, how we do it, is independent from the way another individual or group may do it in another place or another time. So that's important to remember, and having tolerance and acceptance for the great diversity in the unity of effort. So working can be focused, we might say, as said, within ourselves, in working on our thoughts, our feelings, our motives, or work can be outward, making ourselves more fit instruments in our physical nature, or working in our workplace or school or community to help improve the conditions there. So it becomes a very practical emphasis. Once again, not work is not only within and without, it's also individual and universal or collective. As we're working for the benefit of all in very practical ways, we are also helping ourselves. And because of our interconnectedness, we cannot improve our own condition without having a wider influence on the whole. But getting down and looking at this idea of work a little more deeply, we are encouraged to study any topic, not just superficially, but dig in a little deeper. We might say that any kind of work, physical, theosophical, ethical, moral, requires an agent. It requires a medium or material, and it requires a force that agent is going to exert on the material and perform the work. So the agent here is fundamentally ourselves. But most of us think of ourselves as separate from other selves, as having weaknesses and limitations, maybe a sense of separateness from others and the world at large. And so we have a very limited view of ourself, and therefore a very limited view of our potential. And one of the things is, if about human beings, if you believe your capacity to do work is limited, Well, guess what? The force you exert is limited. We are limited in the effect by which we benefit ourselves and the world by our ideas, the ideas we hold in our mind. And so a part of our study here and the work we do in application of that study is to gain a larger, a truer, a higher view of ourself, to see ourselves not just as personal and separate, but as one in essence with that absolute unity, undifferentiated divine principle, which is the source, the self, we might say, of all being, all nature. And we are in one essence with that. So in our inner nature, we are not separate from each other, from nature, from that divine essence. All the divine attributes we can think of, all the great powers of nature that we can imagine, lie resident with us, either latent or developed to a certain degree of potential, or what we might say in the perfected human being, have their most complete expression possible on this plane. So there is that agent. How do we think about ourselves when we work? And then there is the medium. We can certainly work on the medium of our physical bodies, trying to make them better instruments. We can certainly work through the medium of writing, or through the medium of using our bodies in ways that extend fellowship. Maybe just all we can do is smile and be nice to people and open doors for people and be polite and courteous. Maybe that's all the medium we can do. Or maybe we have a gifted use of speech or artistic ways. So there's a medium that each one of us had, unique to us, by which we can, as agents, affect the world. But there's also the inner medium. There is the essence of our minds, of our personalities. Thoughts and ideas, we might say, are things. If you don't think a thought has substantial force, just think what happens to you when certain ideas or feelings arise in your mind. It has a physical impact on our bodies. It has a physical force and it influences substance. Only substance can influence another substance in some degree. So we work within that inner nature, that inner substance of which our minds and our feelings are made up, and we work on the outer. And then there is the force we use. And for human beings, our primary force is the way we use our minds as thinkers. That's what distinguishes us from all the other kingdoms of our nature. That's why our evolution is through self-induced, self-devised effort of self-conscious thinkers, because our thought is a great force in nature, only limited by the ideas that we hold. Change your ideas, you change yourself, you change the world in which you live, individually and collectively. And it's only ever taken for any true human development, or the opposite of human development, human regression, it only takes a core of thinkers, a nucleus of thinkers thinking in a certain direction, to raise or retard the whole. And hopefully more and more individuals will work towards raising humanity. So the force that we use as thinkers is our faculties, our mental faculties. And there are two, we might say, that there are the king and the queen of all our faculties. The king, we might say, is our will. Nothing gets done without will. And as has been often pointed out, will is a colorless force that we give direction to by the kind of desires or motives we hold. The old expression was, behind will stands desire. You desire something and your will brings it about. Keep your desires focused, keep them few, keep them elevated, and the individual, through their will, can accomplish great things. It's only when our desire becomes diffused over many, many things that the will force to get things done becomes diffused as well. Just think of yourselves when you've had a day where there's just too many things that seem to attract your desire to get done. Well, you know at the end of the day, you've either done a very incomplete job on many of them, or you're totally wiped out and exhausted. So we learn in work to focus our desires, to keep them one-pointed, and that's very important. So next in will is imagination. The reason we don't get things done, the reason our work is not successful, is because we don't carry a clear image in our mind of what we want to achieve. It's maybe negative. For example, we say, well, I'm going to work because I don't want the opposite. So you go to work, but maybe you don't do as good job, or you're not enthusiastic about it, but you're just there because you don't want to starve, or you don't want to be in poverty, or you don't want to be sick. You have to be there, but you really hate your job or hate the conditions. But if imagination is focused on the positive, if your ideal of why you're there, what your goal is, that only increases your productivity and the effectiveness of your work. So we have desire, we have motive, we have will, and we might say that of all, if there's a king and a queen, we might always say there's a prince of our faculties, and that would be our faith, the prince of peace. Faith establishes the will and confirms the imagination, as Paracelsus said, but not the kind of faith that's focused on things or people or things outside ourselves, but faith that the kind of Jesus taught, where he said, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed and you said to that mountain, move, it would move. And the only kind of faith that has that power is the faith we have in ourselves and our ability to know and learn and improve. And once again, not faith in our personal selves, but faith in ourselves as expression of the divine self, that we are one with in our essence, with in unity. Our higher self is one with in an aspect of universal self, whether we call it God or the root of all being, or Ein Sof, or whatever idea we hold in our mind as that ultimate reality, we are one with that. And therefore, to have faith and conviction in that, we just have a little bit of that. We not only deliver ourselves from great evil, as Krishna says, but we can accomplish wondrous things, even greater than Jesus did. And that's what he said. Even greater things that I do, you will be able to do. So we come here to the end of this presentation on work. And so we invite you now for your questions and comments, thoughts on these two subjects of work and study, not just theosophical work, but any way in which we might apply those two ideas in our life. Yes.
I have a question. Gurdjieff, the works of Gurdjieff and the fourth way in his talks with Ospensky, and they talk a lot about work and groups and how to achieve progress. And I think that Gurdjieff may have been around the same time as Blavatsky. If you're familiar with him, do you know if there's any record of the two of them working together?
Well, we believe Gurdjieff was more in the influence in the 20th century, is that correct? Most of his work?
Most of the work late 18th century.
And early 20th. So we have heard that he was familiar with those ideas. We do not know, though, the details of any specific interaction. But we do know his writings, of course, have been become more popular, perhaps we should say, in the 20th century, the influence of Gurdjieff and Uspensky. Yes.
There's something curious about the idea of imagination. We found in the glossary that it describes or defines imagination as memory of preceding lives. And we had never understood that idea about memory. But we can understand that our ideas or imagination, it has to come from something. Cannot just come from nothing.
We think maybe what you're referring there to is HBB's idea that we cannot imagine anything in our minds, whether it be the most realistic concept or the most complete fantasy, that does not have some basis in reality. In other words, just as nothing comes from nothing on the physical plane, there's always pre-existing substance that's used in the formation of that object, so too in our minds, we cannot formulate an idea that we imagine without its being based on some grain of truth, some idea. And that may be an idea we bring forth from our previous lives, but it not necessarily. So imagination then is a creative faculty by which we have a clear vision of what we want to achieve, but it is also can be a very fanciful faculty. Many of the reasons we don't do things is because of our faulty or distorted imagination, which leads us to unnecessary fears. Not only does this affect our work, but it can also affect our health as well.
Yeah, and we bring forward from previous lives different ideas and feelings that are based in karma for the present life. So we have those, that imagination can be determined by karma for this particular life. So what we are able to imagine can be limited or might even be made even broader by what we're bringing forward from a past life.
So is that in reference to the skandhas, those bundles of tendencies? How do we combat the negativity, in a sense, that we may have been raised in a very non-nurturing environment, maybe, you know, provided for materially, but not emotionally supported? Where do we start? Where do we begin?
Well,
we humans, which is one of the things that differentiates us from the lower kingdoms, is that we have free choice, and we were talking about will. So even if we are brought up in a less than desirable environment, we still have those choices as to kind of break up that negativity. The awareness that we do have those choices is definitely something that we think many people feel like they're stuck in that environment, whereas they do have a choice to look at things differently and change those, maybe not their environment, but their mode of thinking, their motive as to why they want to change. And we hear all the time about people that are incarcerated, that it was the way they were thinking, their mind, that maybe changed their outlook on things so that when they were released, the recidivism wasn't there.
In the question, some terms were used, that of skandhas. Well, skandha is a Buddhist term, and it refers to those tendencies and qualities that make up our nature, physical, mental, feeling nature, the way we perceive things, that we inherit from our past lives, that we sort of bring over. They may be the inheritance of the previous lives or several lives, but they are tendencies under karma that we bring over, the effects of previous causes. And so we may find that we have very vivid, sharp, creative, imaginative powers, or we may be more fanciful and daydreaming. We may be the kind of person that always imagines the glass half full or the glass half empty. So there's a bent, we might say, to that. And so HPB indicated that regarding our illnesses, except for our illnesses caused by accident or heredity, much of our illnesses are brought on by the incorrect use of our imagination, and also brought on by fear. And she said regarding imagination, you have to correct its tendencies. You have to, and that's where the study comes in. How can you correct your imagination if you don't focus your study on yourself? If you don't take the viewpoint of the perceiver and the observer and look at the way you think and imagine things, the way you feel about things, when something happens to you, how are you going to do something? What do you imagine to the outcome to be? Or what do you imagine the person meant? You have to study yourselves like you would study a subject. You have to become a scientist, a spiritual or a mental or a moral, an inner scientist and not just the outward directed scientist, and study yourselves that way before you can make those corrections. Yes?
Yes, I have a question. So say that you work really hard in this life and you get, you know, first off you get discovering this place and studying and changing and you get to a certain level. When you come back in your next life, are you starting from scratch again or are you building on where you were?
Okay.
In other words, you have to go through like a long process to discover the ULT or whatever. Where is your karma so good from this life that you're going to start at kind of a better level?
Well, if Krishna was up here instead of ourselves, he would respond to you the same way he did to Arjuna. When Arjuna asked him a question, he says, "What happens to the devotee whose efforts are broken off by death? What happens to him?" And Krishna basically says, well, never to an evil place does an individual who doeth good. In other words, and he goes on to say that the individual is either born in a pure, unfortunate family, or he's brought into those very conditions which allow him to continue from where he left off. Now, those conditions may seem favorable or unfavorable to ourselves and personality, but the conditions we are in are just what we need to learn to continue to develop from where we left off. So evolution, in a sense, for a human being, proceeds that way. We don't start from scratch, from nothing. We start under law from following through as an effect from the causes we've set up in the past.
And also, whatever you have learned in this life, and especially if you're, even if it was just a few years in at the end of your life that you were focusing on these higher ideas, they will be assimilated. So that even if, as was stated, maybe you're checked by karma in a next life, you don't lose what you've learned, especially if they're higher ideals, such as if we're concentrating and studying these ideas, they aren't lost.
You have a question?
I was just curious if there's like a connection with like bloodlines, like ancestral bloodlines, if we have some kind of attachment or like responsibility to like clear those like bloodlines, is that like a karmic thing or something? Like, is that just a way of like placing blame on a situation or like past lives, like things?
Well, in your question, when you refer to bloodlines, do you mean our physical heredity that we inherit from our family? Okay. So heredity is sometimes brought up as an objection to the teaching of reincarnation, but actually it's a proof of reincarnation. Heredity is just nature's means of bringing back to us that which we've set up as a cause in the past. As souls, as thinkers, we've acted in certain ways and under the law of cause and effect, which action and reaction, as you sow, so shall you reap. Whatever you do in the way of an act comes back to the source. And what goes around comes around, another way. So we incarnate and we bring with us from the past a certain spiritual, mental, psychic heredity, but our physical heredity comes to us from the family in which we incarnate. And the family that we incarnate with its physical heredity, we are responsible for, in a sense, that we come back to face those conditions as a result of previous efforts, because in the past we have done certain things to create them. So if we come into a family that's musically inclined or physically inclined in any way, it's because as souls we've developed that tendency, and so we have that opportunity. We may use it properly or we may waste it. So karma only brings back to us that previous experience. We may improve it, as you said, if there is a tendency of the family that we can work through, improve, learn to ameliorate, keep minimal in our lives, then we should do that. If there's a tendency that can be very helpful, then we should use that as well.
And just a little bit to add to that is that when we reincarnate and we come back to friends and family, acquaintances, that we still have lessons left to learn. And sometimes we come back because we come back into a certain family or we meet a friend and there's that instant connection. Sometimes just love will also bring us back into the circle of a certain person. So just wanted to add that to what he said.
Was there a question over here?
There's an interesting statement in the declaration regarding study, and it's that the lodge welcomes to its association those who are in accord with its purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. And when we read fit themselves, we think that's not a matter of reading a book, you know? So by study and otherwise, yes, we have to learn about ourselves and do the work, but to fit oneself, one has to study oneself and find out what kind of work one needs to do on oneself. And that could be referring to the inner work that was brought up earlier.
And everybody is different, so there are going to be situations or ideas that will attract some and not others. So one of the things in fitting ourselves is trying not to compare ourselves with somebody else, thinking, oh my goodness, look, they just know how to say these things so that everybody understands. I'll never be able to do that. So in regards to studying ourselves, we have to be gentle with ourselves and know that we are where we are supposed to be. And as long as we do our best, we don't have to be the best expounder of the law or these ideas, just so long as our motive is pure, that we want to share these ideas with others, it will come through. And you may be the kind that you don't really think that you understand these ideas, but when you meet a newcomer or somebody is, you know, at a party and somebody's wanting to know the philosophy, you may be able to be that best person to explain it in a way that somebody who has no idea about theosophy can make, whereas that person who can sit up on a platform and just expound and put these ideas in wonderful, glowing terms, but maybe people can't understand what they're talking about. So, you know, we have to learn to be gentle with ourselves, and there are different ways, there are different ideas. It's like we said in the beginning talk, some people may be drawn to the Bhagavad Gita and think it's the best thing. They get a lot out of it. They can quote. They can express it to other people. But when it comes to the voice of the silence, they may think, oh, I don't understand any of it. But our personalities will attract to us what it is that we will be the best at in studying.
We think another idea in terms of that words of fitting ourselves. Many of us come to these ideas and ideals with the perception, how in the world am I ever going to be able to help somebody else? I can't even help myself. I have so many faults. I've created such a mess out of my life. I don't even know where to begin. And now you're telling me that I'm responsible and I've done all this and, nobody else is to blame but me. That only makes me feel worse, not better. So how am I going to begin? Well, you know, the Buddha said that he who, or she who conquers one fault in themselves is greater than the conqueror of nations. And Krishna says even a little of this practice delivers a person from great risks. So it may be that fitting oneself is sort of like working for others. You don't have to be the greatest scholar, the greatest orator, the greatest writer. You just have to use your ordinary faculties of speech and the way you react to people to be very effective. And fitting yourself could be just a reminder to be a little more patient with others, a little more patient with yourselves, because after all, we're here for more than one life. And in our real nature, we're eternal, with endless opportunities to grow. So why not be patient? Even that little bit of checking oneself can make one a lot more fit to help others.
Bye. Last quarter of the 18th century, 19th century, when public education became a law, in other words, they established the public education, kindergarten, first grade, high school, and made it possible for the commoner, to use that term, to send his children to school to be taught. There was no such thing as that 100 years or 200 years before, except among the wealthy and those that could afford it. So, the term kindergarten, where the stimulation begins, well, we well know that wonderful talent was brought out by public education. And even the freed slaves in that part of the century sent their children to school. And it's our knowledge or understanding that even if there was no public school present, the masters and their former masters offered education. The result is obvious that it is already inherent, but has to be stimulated and brought out. And lots of talent was established that way. We don't have to go into detail. We know that even the immigrants from Europe and Asia, everywhere, came here to the United States and education did wonders.
Yes. Well, the meaning of the word education comes from the Latin educare, to bring out. And perhaps this is what the contribution before was referring to, that all learning is but a remembering of the past. Well, you can learn more in 6 months of a, quote, theosophical education that you can learn in all the universities of the world. Because all those universities, as important as they are specialized. They teach the acquirement of facts about things outside of ourselves as spiritual beings. And they teach them in a way in which you focus on this and focus on that and focus on this thing. Very often the inner connection between all of that is missed. In other words, it's the focus on the particulars and not on the universals. But in a theosophical education, you understand those particulars, you investigate those particulars, but you examine how they all fit together in one unity, how they all are an expression of universal brotherhood of ideas and concepts, how all the different departments of nature are interdependent and reflect one another. But more importantly, you learn as you're studying all those things outside yourself, you're also learning about yourself. You are in a copy of the universe, as above, so below, as the Hermetic philosophers used to say. So that's how we gain, that's the kind of study we're engaged in here. And it's an opportunity that one can find in very few places in the world. Fortunately, though, we do live in a time where we have freedom of thought, and freedom of opportunity, and certainly the technology of now to reach out and contact many more folks than could be done in the past. So we're going to end here for today, but just to remind you that next week we are continuing along the theme for June of practical theosophy, but looking at it in terms of the inner life, that of true prayer and meditation. Our meeting's adjourned.